Hey, Bobby Manning here. Welcome to Dome Theory 70. Been pretty proud of how far we've come since Dome Theory started, and I'm extremely proud of this phenomenal episode we got today with Caitlin Cooper, Indie Cornrows. It's her second appearance on the program to talk about this mini-series that we're in the midst of, Celtics Pacers, wacky, gritty, and sloppy, more sloppy than gritty. And mostly just mistakes and offensive ineptitude led to the low scoring and tightly contested game that we saw in Boston. More than anything extravagant that the defenses were doing out there. But it ends with this Jason Tatum game tying baseline shot that finally gave this Garden crowd that has just been in agony over the last couple weeks watching this team a release valve there. So we'll talk about the state of the Celtics going through the new year, around the holidays. Didn't get to talk a ton about what was going on there. Now we have kind of a big picture over the last few weeks here, so I'm excited to do that with Caitlin, get her take on the team and just the weird issues that they've been having, as well as the progress. Let me just say, from watching this team in person, and I was in New York last week for the collapse, I was at the big win, bouncing back from that, as well as the Indiana game on Monday. And there's a couple things I'm seeing here. There's definitely a disconnect right now between the stars of this team in terms of who's mainly doing the ball handling responsibilities and playmaking and calming the team. Now, everything Ime said in New York last week was pretty valid to me in terms of, let's just say, the need for a leader to stand up as well as someone to calm things down during hectic times. And I was actually pleasantly surprised to see Jalen do that for 43 minutes on Monday. So a pretty quick response there. He had 11 assists on Saturday as well in the bounce back win. So he kind of answered that call. I'm seeing this weird Jason Tatum bike thing continue. I don't know what to make of it. I pursued it a little bit earlier this year, but kind of hit a dead end. I thought it might have signaled when he was struggling early on that he was dealing with some kind of injury, trying to stay loose. And warm was essentially the answer that I got. No ailment there, obviously. He's played some of the most minutes in the league. But he continues to go over that bike, and he's pedaling less and less. It's more that he's just sitting over there, which is a weird thing that I've never seen a player do. Just not go to the bench, not communicate all that much. And there was a weird moment on Monday where Jalen and Grant were getting into it over a defensive breakdown, and Schroeder kind of pushed Brown away, and Rob took Grant and ended the altercation right there. Al Horford tuned in a little bit to some degree, and Jason was just sort of slowly strolling over from the bike. Now, he's kind of talked about his quiet, subtle leadership style in the past. Essentially is content in the way that he goes about things, even though it's not, I guess as he would say, loved by everybody on the outside, or is what people would prefer him to be as a leader. And the team genuinely seems to be okay with the way in which Tatum goes about it in terms of setting an example rather than being a vocal guy. But in a time where he's the playmaker and he's the guy that's being relied upon to communicate in these chaotic moments, and I did ask him in New York what it kind of takes to get through those, and that is what he said, communication. I don't know how the bike thing helps in that regard. Now, does it hurt? I can't say that. It might mean nothing. I know Josh Richardson kind of quipped about it in an Instagram comment on his own post after the game, but it's interesting to see that become more of a thing, even if it's only subtle. To start the week here, and that is definitely something I saw through some of the lower moments of the Indiana game, and he did struggle in it with 8 turnovers and assists. Whenever he went to the bike, or whenever he went to the bench, it was the bike. He didn't go to the bench, he went right to the bike. So that's another thing I'm seeing there. And then, of course, that disagreement between Brown and Grant, a pretty fiery one from Grant's end, clapping in his face, trying to tell him to get together. That seemed like more of a positive to me. Definitely helped that group burst through the final minutes there and figure things out as they were collapsing up 10. So that would have been another really bad loss. Celtics pull it out. And we'll talk about it with Caitlin right after this and a few sponsors here. Calm.com. Of course, it is a new year. Some of the chaos of the holidays is back, but it's still a tough time for mental health. The sun going down sooner and just a busy, busy time, you know, jumping back into school work and all the different things after the holiday here. And you got to tune down after a long day, and it's still easiest to do that with some meditation, with some sounds to rock you to sleep, essentially. And Calm just has so many different options when it comes to your mental health and just things that are going to help you sleep better at night, which is kind of the key, as LeBron would say, to his career has been sleep. So go try it. We're giving you a great opportunity to just go out there and try it. Calm.com/garden. Go out there and take advantage of everything that the app has to offer. I use it every night with the thunderstorm sound. I've been saying that for a while. Like, it's a great... It works for me. There's going to be something there that works for you. Everybody's different in terms of what they need and what they respond to. They have all different kinds of answers, whether it's yoga, meditation, and, of course, those sounds, fans, storms, the beach, it's all there. So go get 40% off that and support Dome Theory and The Garden Report. LinkedIn.com/garden as well. It's obvious the labor market is just crazy right now. Everybody's looking for employees. There's a labor shortage, disconnect, whatever you want to call it. Well, LinkedIn's going to bridge it. They are going to allow you to post a job for free and connect to candidates who are qualified for your position. And there's hundreds of millions on LinkedIn. Everybody's on LinkedIn. You know about it. So LinkedIn.com/garden. Go post your job for free and find the right candidate today. And, of course, from day one, betonline.ag. Ton of stuff this weekend over there on betonline.ag. We got football, the playoffs. Bengals, 5.5-point favorites over the Raiders. I will take them. Bills have moved down to 4-point favorites over the Patriots on BetOnline from what I saw before. I like the Bills begrudgingly there. I'm really excited for that game. That's a fun matchup. That's the one we wanted in terms of excitement, but maybe not in terms of winning probability for the Patriots there. I know the Celtics are playing at the same time. I think I'm going to be staying home from that game. Eagles-Buccaneers. Guess that's how it panned out in the wild card out there in the NFC. Ooh, that's a tough one. I'm going to stay away from that one. That one seems dangerous given what's going on in Tampa the last few weeks here. Ooh, 49ers-Cowboys. That's a fun one. Wow. Some good games this weekend. Ooh, I'm going to go Cowboys -3. And then we get Steelers-Chiefs. Chiefs 12.5. Going Chiefs. Cardinals-Rams. I mean, there's got to be an upset here somewhere, right? That's a tough one for the Rams, huh? This one bye really creates some difficult matchups for teams that would typically be in the range for that second bye there. Let's take the points on Arizona. They've been tricky this year, but I'm gonna try to go against the grain on at least one of these. I mean, there's no way the Chiefs are going to let down against Pittsburgh, right? San Fran, outside chance that they push the Cowboys. Not enough points there to really make it worth it. The Eagles, I wouldn't knock you if you go Eagles there. Getting a ton of points, 8.5. Pats, of course, I know they'll be very popular, and it looks like they have been so far. And I don't see the Raiders pushing the Bengals, but it's not like the Bengals are this proven playoff product there. So a ton of different ways you can go, but I'm going Bengals, Bills. Oof, I'm staying away from the Bucks game, Cowboys, Chiefs, and Cardinals. Let's roll with that. And you can get in on the action, too, at betonline.ag this weekend. They're wishing you a happy betting new year as they continue the march into the playoffs and beyond. They're the number one spot for all the best sports wagering action in 2022. Happy New Year, by the way. And with it, a new updated desktop and mobile website. If you're new to it, then you got to go over there and see it. I'm looking at it right now, and it is beautiful. Sign up today, receive 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Just use the promo code CLNS50 to get started. From football, basketball, hockey, boxing, UFC, right to your favorite Vegas casino games. Don't wait to take advantage of all the amazing offers for 2022. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to wager on all your favorite sports. BetOnline, where the game begins. Here is Caitlin Cooper on Dome Theory 70. Go subscribe, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify. She also writes at IndieCornrows.com, so get her columns, video breakdowns, X's and O's there. She's one of the smartest basketball minds out there, period. And I think that came across in our live stream when we recorded it earlier. A ton of people just impressed, and I always am too. I always come away learning something when I talk to Caitlin. So here she is on the Pacers-Celtics miniseries, and we, of course, are going to be live after that. Game 2 at 7 o'clock, Celtics-Pacers tonight. So here's Caitlin. Hey, Bobby Manning here. Welcome to Dome Theory, number 70 in the first of 2022. It's a good time to do it with Caitlin Cooper here from Indy Cornrows. She joined us last year to talk about these two teams in the big picture, and here they are in similar places to the last time we convened on them. Brown Tatum, a big conversation this week. They're fit together. And Miles Turner and Domantas Sabonis still trying to figure out where those two guys are going to go and what Indiana's going to do as an organization here. Welcome, Caitlin. Great to have you back.
Hey, thanks for inviting me back on. Always glad to be able to come on and talk about controversial pairings that fan bases have heated opinions about. So,
well, these are the two top of the order when it comes to that. And I've been talking forever about just how these two teams seem primed to help each other out in that. Like, maybe this is just the solution that both need, swapping out the middle parts of their roster. We'll get to that at the end. I want to start with the game here because this is what you do so well. This is what I'm trying to figure out how to do, is break down these games and just see what the hell happened out there last night, because that was one of the sloppiest mess of a game all season, and it had this really fun ending in overtime. The back and forth between Sabonis, Tatum, game time shot at the just before the buzzer there. Brown with an incredible overtime on the ball there with no point guards around him. It was just a wacky game that had this really satisfying outcome, I think, for a lot of Celtics fans. I mean, the crowd was into it there last night after Tatum's shot and Brown making big shots and doing everything else there. Let's just start with the big decision down the stretch by Indiana to take Turner off the floor with about 4 minutes left and pretty much roll with Sabonis, Lance Stephenson, Torrey Craig, and Justin Holiday. It was just the bottom of Indiana's barrel there, and Sabonis trying to make it all work. Like, his stat line was ridiculous out of this one.
Right, so I think that some of the thought process, because, I mean, Miles basically didn't play most of the fourth quarter. He had four fouls at the end of the third. So I think at first, Rick Carlisle was probably trying to protect that, so if they needed him down the stretch, he would be there. And then that group started rolling a bit when Boston was smaller. I mean, obviously Horford didn't play at the end of the game, which a lot of Miles' minutes were being matched when both bigs were out there. I think mainly what they were looking at, if you go back and watch the film, a lot of times, and the Pacers and other teams around the NBA have been doing this at times too. I saw it on Christmas Day where Phoenix was doing this some with Ayton against Stephen Curry. And then obviously in the Laker game with the Nets, the Lakers were also doing this against James Harden. The Pacers, if Jason Tatum or Jaylen Brown was isolating, they were bringing another defender over there. And that was the case whether Sabonis was there alone in the isolation. I mean, they already used a hedge scheme, but if it was just alone in ISO, they were bringing extra guys to trap with selective traps. If you're going to do that and you have to scramble and rotate out, that's going to be really hard to do with two bigs on the floor. So I think at that point, it was the calculus of, you know, which center do we want to leave out there? And if you look at what Boston was doing at the other end of the floor, they were switching and protecting against the roll pretty well and then doubling Sabonis. So I think the thought process was, you know, we need to have mobile length with Craig and Justin and O'Shea defensively, that the other end, those are our best cutters. In theory, Justin is a gravity off-ball movement shooter. Miles wasn't shooting the ball well last night. So if they need guys, because they're not going to get as much out of pick and roll and they need to play around Sabonis in the post, they wanted to have guys who are going to be doing more intuitive movement. And Miles here over these last five games has really kind of struggled. Like, quietly, he's had more fouls than field goals made. He's shooting like 18% from three, his plus minus numbers, which that's not all about him. I don't really like looking at that as an individual stat, but his swing rating is the worst on the team, I believe, over that time too. So when you look at it, a lot of times the narrative that gets brought up with him is, you know, and I mean, and he said this too, I'm a glorified role player there. And I'm sympathetic to that to an extent, because I think that there have been throughout the season some ways that he's improved, but you can also watch the games and see very clear places. I mean, watch Torrey Craig last night. They were not running plays for Torrey Craig. He was cutting and shooting out of those double teams, making shots. That's stuff that Miles can do. He just needs to recognize it even when plays aren't being run directly for him. And he's had some struggles with that the last few games where he's just seemed kind of lost. So I think that some of the responsibility also falls on him. Obviously, he had the cryptic tweet after the game, and maybe, I mean, there's probably a case to be made that the Pacers ran out of gas a little bit towards the back end. And if he wasn't in foul trouble, my guess is he would have played at the start of the fourth quarter at the very least. But because he was, you know, they ran with what lineup was working. And you know, I think that they ran out of gas a little bit offensively, especially when I think they were up 89-85. And then they went 0-for on four straight possessions that I felt was like a really critical stretch for them where they could have closed it out and just didn't. So,
yeah, Torrey did call his own number at one point. Yeah. I think that was the air ball, right?
Yeah.
He threw up there. That just left Rick Carlisle, like, what's going on here? And some of the stuff Stevenson's doing is miraculous at times. I think that he had the 20-point quarter against Brooklyn there in his first game. And, you know, he had some big moments down the stretch here too, but also just some baffling stuff from him at this point in his career. It's unbelievable seeing him in a Pacers uniform at this point, playing big minutes, taking crunch time shots. It's unreal. Now, you mentioned the blitzes that they were throwing at Tatum. He handled those well. He didn't have a great game. I think it was one assist, eight turnovers. The stuff that Boston did down the stretch against that was encouraging to me. Getting him off the ball a little to do some stuff off there and using Grant as the corner guy as like a passing outlet off of that down the stretch was good. I think that was a relief for a lot of Celtics fans who watched Smart, Schroeder, Tatum, and two bigs playing in the fourth quarter to try to make some stuff happen off the ball away from plays like that. And this was really the key play of the game to me that I'm going to pull up here is Tatum going to the corner there. And I believe this is Turner on the floor here in overtime with about a minute 20 to go. And what you mentioned there is right. Like, they just weren't able to rotate well enough out of this. And it pretty much just leaves Rob wide open to get this offensive rebound down low against I believe that Stevenson there just shrugging after he couldn't get his hands on the ball. And then you see just some, finally, Brown and Tatum connecting out of this. I got to go to the next page here for the second part of this play. This was everything here. Brown, the poise that he showed in overtime, him and Tatum just finally playing off each other a little bit here. Tough shot. Simple little pass, but this is stuff that they weren't doing early in the season.
Yeah, that's a really good read by Tatum. If you roll that one back, that's a good read by him, because you see again that Grant's over in the corner and they were doubling those. They get a middle isolation there with Tatum at the free throw line. They were doubling with Craig coming off of Grant, and Tatum spins away from that potential trap. So they don't want to bring Lance off as the only person on what would have been the ball side corner. So then he gets an actual single isolation. That's one of the few times where they didn't trap him. So that was a really good read. Obviously, it's somewhat of a balance between pressure and containment. Like, you know, they wanted to take the ball out of their hands if they could, or at least make it hard and make them see multiple bodies. And then on that one, you know, Grant gets the wide open three. And then in the other one, they gave up the offensive rebound, as you said, because Sabonis had to chase out. I mean, yeah, even the shot that Tatum made at the end of regulation, if you look at that one, they tried to trap that. And that was when Sabonis came out, Miles went in to try to get a stop on the last possession, and Tatum goes baseline. And I believe Lance is about a step too slow getting over there to try to double to make that a tougher shot. So that was a key play where they tried to trap again, and they just didn't get it.
Yeah, and they got the on the transition run out before that. I think, one player actually did get a hand on the ball there. Here, it was just kind of Turner in space against Tatum, and Tatum was just a little quicker than him to that baseline step here. You know, the help didn't come. Yeah.
You
which
can
was
see
unbelievable.
That, yeah, Lance yeah, comes Stevenson's off and they try to double it, and he's about a step slow and Tatum just drills the jumper.
Yeah, and that was a great moment. The crowd was getting restless. There weren't boos. I thought boos were gonna come in at some point when they started stumbling to start the fourth quarter there. I think Indiana went on like a 8-0 run to begin that fourth quarter and get themselves back into this after trailing by 10 there. I want to look at some Sabonis film. That is fun stuff out of this one. This play right here, the Torrey Craig corner three, where Boston, I believe this is the play where they collapse on him, almost forced a turnover down low. Yeah, Rob gets in on it here. He loses the ball and just, boom, fires it right to Craig and gets a three there. This guy is so good as a passer. Not much shooting around him in this one. Not much for in the way of help out there with Indiana having what they have left in this one, but he just keeps making stuff happen.
Yeah, I think he finished what did he end up finishing with? I think he had like 10, 23, and 10 or something along those lines. I think that he missed some point blank bunnies that I'm sure he wished that he could have back that I think in the next game will go down if he gets those again. There was a few times where I felt like he turned in to the trap where his teammates probably could have alerted him like, hey, you know, Rob's coming from the weak side, and he turned into it. But by the fourth quarter, between O'Shea's one of their best cutters in terms of not spoiling spacing, and Torrey's really improved with that. And one thing that I think people probably don't think about with Torrey is that he's played with Jokic. So sometimes his rhythm can be a little bit off, but he has a better sense for how to play around some of those post-ups because of that experience he has in Denver. So, I mean, that was a lot of where Sabonis' assists were coming from, was just Torrey Craig actually making shots, which, granted, doesn't happen every game, but him making that 45 cut or him, you know, there was one spot down to stretch where I didn't really understand where he came and screened for the ball. And then that put Robert Williams back on the post up against Sabonis. That was a little bit awkward, but overall Torrey was huge in that game. And like I said before, they weren't running. None of this is plays for Torrey Craig. This is post ups for Sabonis. And then those guys just making reads around it. And by the start of the game, they weren't really hitting those threes early. And Kiefer was kind of having some trouble because Marcus Smart was really ducking under hard against him, even against rescreens, and his release isn't really quick. So they could only really go with Lance as the other on ball creator late. You're not going to get a lot of creation out of Justin and Torrey and O'Shea. Obviously they didn't have LeVert, they didn't have Brogdon, so that limited some of what they could do in that extent. And it's also why they had to play Jeremy kind of as much as they did, because he's one of the few other guys that can kind of get his own shot against the switch. But for what they had, as many like kind of laugh out loud possessions as occurred in the first half of this game between both teams, I think that the Pacers have to feel pretty decent that, given as depleted as they were, that they made it a game by the end of the game.
And this is the stuff I love from Sabonis. You get a better shooter here out of this play, and this is just a money one right here. You know, you pull Grant out to the right there. Tatum gets stuck on the screen. Grant's too late to rotate there. But, again, he just didn't have the help in this one to win it. And he still almost did with just a ridiculous heavy lifting line there. I think it was 11, 23, and 10, the triple-double for Sabonis there. You know, Craig has a decent game. Stevenson gave them some stuff there. But without Brogdon, without Duarte, without you know, McConnell, Warren, and all the other guys that they're missing here, it is just brutal season. And I guess you're just basically looking at, all right, Indiana can get a top 10 pick out of just this injury riddled season. You make a decision on one of those bigs into the offseason, and you still have a pretty good team set in place here. I think what happened there in that Athletic article, talking about, I guess, moving on from one of the bigs and doing a soft rebuild here, that's probably the right way to go about this, because they have enough, if they're fully healthy, to be competitive here. And when you think of how good they were a couple of years ago out of the bubble there. So I don't know. Where do you think this team is ultimately going in the future?
Yeah, I mean, like the Celtics, the close games have been killer for the Pacers. I mean, their net rating is not reflective of what their record is. I think that they're like a middling net rating, and then they've lost so many games in the clutch and closing time that it's really impacted them. I don't think that's all bad luck. I think some of it has been, but I think that they've also struggled against exaggerated coverages at times when teams start really trapping them. They haven't always played out of it as well, and I do think that the coaching staff's made some good adjustments of late in terms of, I mean, some of the stuff that you just mentioned there, in terms of what they've been allowing Sabonis to do. Early in the year, he was really kind of de-emphasized. They wanted to play this more egalitarian style that was a little bit more being triggered by the guards rather than the interior. And they were also kind of trying to flip-flop some of the stuff to give Turner more reps. And here lately, like, Sabonis has even been doing stuff on ball. Like, you can see him do it, like, last night. He did an inverse pick-and-roll where he's receiving screens at the elbow to be doing stuff that way. He's getting to post way more. He's getting to do more at the elbows, like you're showing with that dribble handoff where he's so good and makes contact and really frees guys out with the amount. Because, I mean, not everybody does that. I mean, you can even see that difference between Miles and Sabonis at times, where Miles' biggest struggle in those situations is that he doesn't dribble at the defender. He dribbles at his teammate. So you're not really creating any sort of advantage there. You're just pitching the ball. You are getting side to side action, but you're not generating separation. So that's been shifted. But like what you said with the soft rebuild reset, like there's been so many verbal gymnastics and semantics around, you know, the Pacers in terms of what all of those words mean and what they're really going to do. I mean, it sounds pretty clear from ownership and the fact that there was an interview during the one game that the Pacers were on TNT where Jared Greenberg had done a sideline interview and had asked Rick Carlisle before the game, if you knew that you were going to a team that would rebuild in your first year as head coach, would you have agreed to go there? And Rick Carlisle said no. And Herb Simon has made very clear that he doesn't want to, you know, he doesn't believe in tanking. And, you know, the Pacers are probably going to get a good pick here anyways, just because of everything you said. Like, they just, you know, they're not performing well. They have guys injured. They're already, you know, have like the sixth worst record in the NBA right now. But for me, if it's, unless you're just, if you were open to being, doing a rebuild, I would be, it's just a matter of asset valuation. You would just be seeing who you could get, what you could get more for between Turner and Sabonis. But if that's not,
that's
what
the tricky thing, right?
Right.
Like, I've heard you talk about this, just how good Sabonis is, how misused he's been next to Turner and just the cast that they have right now. Like he could, you see last night what he's able to do when it's centered around him and he has the ball in his hands and he's a playmaker and is just the center of the action there. But they've been trying to trade Turner, it seems like, for years now, and it's just not there, whether it's the salary, whether it's who he is as a player. I mean, he felt invisible out there at times for me for much of that game last night, and then ultimately he's not out there in crunch time. Great defender, certainly, one of the best shot blockers in the league. He can make a lot happen on that end, but you don't really... Like, even a team like Charlotte or the Knicks or whoever's apparently interested in Turner here, I'm sure if they could get Turner for a decent price, they'd be happy with having him protect the rim, you know, do some role stuff for their team. But you're not going to give the Pacers this massive rebuilding gift in terms of a return to get themselves going with Sabonis there. So Sabonis certainly would get you the greater return, I would imagine, here. But I'm sure you feel, and I feel this way about the Pacers, that they shouldn't give him up. Like, that would just be a disastrous move. He's their best player. He's an all-star. You know, you can do a bigger reset or rebuild, probably, if you're trading him, just because I think you'll get so much more here. But Turner doesn't get you quite enough, I don't think. So that's the tricky conundrum between those two.
Right. I mean, I think in part, some of it for me has to do with the contract length. Like, I just, if you're trying to retool, I find it hard to believe that you're going to find a one for one player when Sabonis is only making $18 million. That's going to give you what you're already getting from Sabonis in a way that you wouldn't just retool around the edges of both bigs then. But with regard to Miles, my general thinking there is, I mean, if you look at what the Pacers have done in the past, they really haven't made trades for picks. They've generally prioritized players. I mean, they traded Paul George for Victor Oladipo and Sabonis, who then did turn
Great
into
deal.
All-Stars. They moved Victor for Caris LeVert, who they thought was going to help them. They've made trades for TJ Warren, obviously. So I tend to think that that's what direction they're going to look. But at the same time, I keep looking at the Aaron Gordon deal as a comp of what the Magic got in return for him. And that I think that it would be like first round pick, expiring deal, and young prospect that they feel good about. So, you know, you'd probably be looking at a situation where it would be like Obi Toppin, expiring picks from New York, or maybe like a Jaden McDaniels picks, Torian Prince, stuff from Minnesota. I know that the Timberwolves have been interested. If you could pry Vanderbilt, I mean, especially because the Pacers are doing a lot more hedging, I think Minnesota's an interesting partner in that regard, because if you're going to run that type of scheme, you're going to need some weak side rim protection, and those guys have been doing that around Karl Anthony Towns all year. Or, you know, PJ Washington. I just think that it would be very hard it would be very hard for me if I were the Pacers to say, you know, we've never actually tried, like, people talk about this roster being built around Sabonis. It is not built around Sabonis. If it were, Doug McDermott would still be on the team.
Yeah.
So, and I understand the luxury tax implications of that, but if it were, Doug McDermott would still be on the team. So I would at least want to see what can we do on the fringes to retool, to see what we can do with him, because he's not in a contract year next year. If it bottoms out and the defense doesn't look good, you can still tear it down. And I don't think anything's going to happen to his value. I think it's still going to be there and you can do the next step then.
Yeah, that's tricky, right?
Because that's what look I would look at.
Charlotte's the team to me in terms of the fit for Turner, because that's all they're missing is that defensive anchor on that end. They got all the offense in the world. He could probably fit into some of the stuff that they do offensively in terms of pace, you know, playoff ball and all the other kind of stuff that they do there down in Charlotte and make some of the best offenses in the league. They're just a disaster on defense, and he's the kind of guy that could help them in that regard. But do those pieces coming back from Charlotte accentuate Sabonis there? Washington, I mean, he has been rough the last year or so here in terms of making shots. For his size, I think he's good at that role. Can he play some five for you? Probably doesn't have to as much if he goes to Indiana, but does he accentuate Sabonis as much as you would want him to there? Then, I don't know, do you get Booknight or something? Obviously, he's kind of unproven and young. And there's some other probably younger, cheaper guys there that make sense maybe from Charlotte. That's the deal to me that's sitting there, because Charlotte has some guys that they probably can't pay after paying a couple of their other guys and needing to pay Ball at some point down the line here. And Indiana, I guess you probably want some younger guys back, but I just don't know, like you mentioned there, with losing McDermott and some of these shooters and stuff, do you get enough back in that regard from Charlotte to make it worth your while? I guess that's just kind of what you're looking at this point with Turner. Like, it's not going to be a golden return. You just got to kind of separate those guys and get the best you can for him at this point. I don't know if it's going to happen at the deadline here. It's probably more of an off-season thing. But I know what you can't do is trade Sabonis. Like, is there any scenario where you deal Sabonis? I guess if you're blown away, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you have to be open to every option and that they would certainly listen to it. But it wouldn't be – the only way you do it, in my opinion, is if it's just an absolute no-brainer.
Like, Here's my question. What is the Pacers team built around Turner – and the return from Sabonis look like?
I mean, to put it nicely, I don't think that there would be a team built around Miles Turner. Yeah. I think that he would be a finishing piece. I mean, like I said, that's why I would do the comparison to Aaron Gordon, because it's like what Denver wanted from him. I mean, he's helped them. He's taking a step back from what his offensive role was in Orlando to be able to play around Jokic and to provide them with the defensive upgrade they needed. I think that's what a team's going to look for from Miles. So if it's the Pacers, it would have to be, you would have to make up that playmaking. And right now, I'm not convinced that that would be the case with just Brogdon and Caris LeVert from what I've seen, because that was kind of what I alluded to earlier. When they get into crunch time situations and teams really start either hedging or blitzing the ball, they have trouble making plays out of that. If Miles Turner is then the release valve at the five, that's going to be pretty iffy.
Yeah. And
those types of situations. And we did see, like, I know people get mad at me because I brought this up, but it is a reality. I'm not going to pretend like Nate McMillan's offense was revolutionary. There was a lot of one and done hitchy action in that Heat series, but some of this type of stuff still shows up against switching defenses. I do think Miles has gotten better at ducking in, being able to use just shoot over the top in mid range. Sometimes he shows a rip through move, but if you're against a switching defense and they're really packing the paint, he's got to be able to find those opportunities to shift that defense in one shape or form. It's like what you saw last night with the Celtics. The Pacers weren't getting a lot out of the pick and roll, but if you could post Sabonis, you were shifting the pieces on the floor. Multiple bodies were going to him, and then other guys were open. You're not going to get that same type of gravity shift from Miles, so you're going to have guys who can create their own shots in isolation, which the Pacers don't have a lot of right now, that can do that at a high level and efficiently. So, I mean, there's not really a clear path right now with either one of them, unless I can see exactly what they're being offered in terms of how you're going to round out the roster, because I also don't think Miles should take all the flack for the rebounding. That's not fair to him, because they have over the last few years not had the best rebounding wings in season prior, but that's another thing that you're going to have to make up for, that you're not going to have Sabonis getting 23 rebounds in a game, and Miles is going to have to improve in that area as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I think this does get answered over the offseason. Like, you got to move Brogdon into this somehow, probably, just in terms of discussions, right? Just in terms of putting everything out there and having all your options on the table. So it is kind of stunning that they took that off the table with the extension there, this season at least. I don't know what becomes of Warren, because he's a free agent at the end of this year, right?
Correct. I mean, there's reporting that he really, I mean, he's a low-key guy. There's reporting that he likes it in Indiana, would like to stay. Now, of course, anything can happen in that situation.
And he's been hurt for a long time.
Right. Nobody's seen him. I mean, that's still somewhat of a mystery of what exactly is going on there. He continues to have positive scans every month, but there's never a timetable for return. So
he'd be the king of scans if it wasn't another guy.
Right, right. So, And with regard to Malcolm Brogdon, I think that that's probably how a lot of people feel. But at the same time, if there's going to be a cap spike and you got him under that reasonable number now, that probably makes his contract even more valuable in terms of how people already see him, because he can fit and slide into so many different roles and teams. So I think that what has been rumbled is that they went ahead and circled back, which, I mean, I'm not going to get into the Ben Simmons discourse, but that they did circle back with the Sixers and make sure one last time, like, are you going to be interested in Malcolm Brogdon? And the Sixers were like, no. And then they went forward with the extension. I think that's what had been reported out of Indiana. So I think that they had done their homework before they went ahead and signed that deal. I mean, the Pacers in general, with the exception of like needing to move on from Victor last year because he was in a contract year and seemed like he was on his way out, they don't make a lot of midseason trades. So they were probably thinking at the beginning of the season, I don't think they anticipated that they were going to get off to this type of start. And part of me in the back of my head, like, I'm not going to pretend the East has gotten better. I'm not going to pretend that they would be, you know, a top team. I expected them to be better than what they are. But if TJ Warren would have been healthy as they expected and Caris LeVert wouldn't have fractured his back, like, just to see exactly what they were, I don't think they would have thought, oh, we're going to be backed into the corner and want to move Brogdon by February in addition to one of our bigs, you know?
They have a lot of talent when you just look at the roster on paper here. And it not working out like the Celtics to some degree, it is concerning here. It's probably a sign that you need to shake up the mix there, but it does give you hope that you don't have to tear this down completely. You don't have to move many core pieces here, and you can still end up in a pretty good position at the end of it. That luxury tax thing you mentioned too is tricky for them, because money's obviously going to motivate a lot of what they do here, probably to some degree. But last question I do have on the Pacers before we move on to some Celtics stuff here, and there is a ton on the Boston end to talk about too. What happened with LeVert this year? Like, it, I guess maybe my expectations were too high for him coming out of Brooklyn, seeing some of his big games there, because it's not like I was watching LeVert night in and night out. I know his numbers probably aren't all that different now than they were there, but he's been a little underwhelming for landing in a situation where he's a little bit more of a priority in terms of what they're doing. And I know we had the medical condition coming into this year. That's probably something he needs to get past a year out or something. But it's been rough, hasn't it, for him this first full year with Indiana?
Right. I mean, what's curious about it is towards the back end of last season, Malcolm Brogdon was out with a hip strain injury. So Caris was doing a lot of the primary ball handling late against Nate Bjorken. And while their defense was a train wreck, the two-man game between Caris and Sabonis, I mean, the two of them were putting up like video game numbers because they were playing at such a like the second highest pace in the league. And the chemistry there was pretty good. Then when this season started, obviously he has the back injury, he comes back and then even when he did come back, he would miss a few games here and there because like he would have to, it was still maintenance, like back soreness. And you could see that he wasn't moving 100% correctly. Like, I think that was still something that he needed to move through. Plus on the sideline, a lot of the time you could see that he was wearing like a back device to try to deal with it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it seems like there's kind of a push and pull between a lot of the roster. Kind of the story that's gone underrated probably outside of Indiana is they started the year running a lot of play calls and there was a lot of micromanaging going on from the sidelines. Then after they had like a three game losing streak where they lost to New York, Detroit, and Charlotte, and the starters got benched in Charlotte, they came back home and they started playing a lot more random offense. And some of the players on the roster take to that better than others. I think Caris can do it to an extent. Sabonis is very good at playing out of random. You don't have to call plays for him, but not everybody makes reads as well out of that as everybody else. So in Caris's case, I feel like he wants to play this herky-jerky game. Like, he plays to his own drumbeat a lot of the time where he wants to go away from picks. And there's times to do that, and there's times when there's not to do that. And he's going to do it and drive into crowds. And it's impacted his playmaking to a degree. I'm not sure that his game fits this, you know, Rick Carlisle Maverick-style offense that requires making, you know, quick decisions and sometimes making the easy play. I mean, even to Lance's credit, it's something that I would not have said about Lance in the prior two times he's been here is that he's just kept a lot of those. He's an unpredictable player, but when he's running pick and roll with Sabonis, he's keeping it simple. Like, he's actually using the screen, reading what the other help defenders are doing. And Caris oftentimes reads what his defender and the screener's defender is doing and doesn't always see what the other three help defenders are doing in terms of where the ball needs to get and win. So he's gotten to do a little bit more primary handling, which has helped his individual numbers. Some of his playmaking started to turn around in December before he got put in health and safety protocols. But I personally just think there's too many spots where, like, he makes a play, but it's not the right play. Like, for instance, he played the Milwaukee Bucks. Sabonis was setting a corner pin-in screen for Miles Turner, who was wide open in the corner, and Sabonis is, like, motioning over and over again, throw it, throw it, throw it. Karis dribbles clear to the other side of the floor and takes a pull-up baseline too. Now, he makes the shot. Is that the right play? No. And, like, a lot of times you're just – he's not going to make up a lot of that on the defensive end. Like, he can defend with his length on ball okay, but his off-ball defense isn't great. So, I do think some of it turned around in December, but I don't think it's everything that they probably – hoped what type of leap he would have made this season.
Let's talk some Celtics. Let's do it. We're in the second half hour here of the show, and they have their own problems, right? this fit between Brown and Tatum has become the talk of the NBA over the last 2 weeks here. The offense is so stagnant, and I find it interesting. I love what Steve Jones said. I know you were on their show a couple weeks ago now talking about Pacers, and Steve Jones was talking about Ime, who's gotten a lot of heat here for not fixing the Celtics quickly over these first 41 games. We're now halfway through the season. The play calls, I know you said that Indiana was micromanaging a lot this season. That's just, I guess, not something NBA teams are doing very often, and certainly the Celtics aren't. I didn't ask Ime about it, but I was there in New York when he was talking about, you know, I'm not going to call a timeout and, you know, call a play and ruin the flow of the game here, which is interesting when you think of Boston's problems, that he's not kind of halting, you know, hitting the brake and saying, let's run some actions here, create some movement and do some stuff. But when you watch them play, everybody's standing around, and this wasn't necessarily the case last night, maybe in the first half more so than the second half, everybody's standing around off ball. Brown and Tatum are trying to do a lot of stuff alone, and Smart and Schroeder trying to make something out of nothing, and you don't have a lot of floor spacing here, and, you know, Rob's great as a pick and roll guy, but they're not running that all the time. So you basically just have these two great players who are trying to do it alone, time in and time out, and they're getting better at it, and they're getting better at playing off each other. But you even look at some of the passing numbers between those two early, and they would pass to each other something as low as 7 times a game between the two of them. Now, that's up into the teens now over the last month or two here. But something is just so broken offensively in Boston. And part of it, obviously, I think, is the Jays playmaking developing and being uneven. Definitely part of it is the talent on this roster around them. But at the same time, like, there's just not a lot going on here in this offense. It's a ton of ISO. I think they have the second highest ISO rate. And certainly Rob just feels ultra underutilized in terms of his talent on the offensive end here. So what to you, from what you've seen this year, is the issue for the Celtics offensively?
Right. So there's a lot to parse through there. Like, breaking down at the beginning when we're talking about play calls, like, I think that you're correct in saying that. I think a lot of teams are moving away from that because by the time you get to the playoffs, opponents are going to have a lot of that scouted. They're going to know what your team's plays are. So you want to be able to play more random or out of concepts because, or, you know, automatics, like, in terms of, you know, okay, when we run a Spain pick and roll or a 2-man game, we use weak side cutting or we don't use weak side cutting or whatever that may be for the person who's the ball handler. But it's going to be harder to know what a team's doing out of random if that, you know, when you get into a playoff situation in terms of what scouting is going to be. So I think that's why teams are leaning towards that a little bit more, but it is going to look ugly. I mean, there's going to be times in the regular season where guys are going to be out of sync and it's not going to be as pretty and it's not going to be as clean, but your hope is that it's going to be less predictable. Mm-hmm. So that might be some of where Udoka is coming from that. And in that regard, like, you can question if that's the right approach or not, because they don't have a lot of top tier playmakers. They don't really have, you know, an elite point guard to play with those two guys. I'm not really sure that either of them have taken the exact leap that they needed to as playmakers, but at the same time, like, they're not really surrounded by elite shooting either. So I think you'd probably want a little bit more of a mix where it's not just them having to do advantage creation all the time, where they're having to kick out to, you know, ho-hum shooters, there would be some times where they would also be getting some of those attempts because you'd have other people that are breaking down the offense a little bit more. But I think some of these issues, and this isn't me trying to downplay Brad Stevens, but I think some of these issues that you're describing existed last year as well. Yes. I mean, at least from what I saw of the Celtics, that there was a lot of catch and hold going on where, you know, you're passing it and then that guy's holding it and kind of dribbling, pounding out the ball. I mean, I think that their numbers showed that they were one of the teams that did the most, like had the most of those types of possessions where it's stationary, where you're dribbling it out, whether it's an isolation or a pick and roll attempt. So I think in one of the games I saw last week, I'm trying to remember that they did let Robert Williams start doing more. Like, I'm not going to say it's the Sabonis stuff, but more out of like the elbows and the high post where he was doing a little bit more with split cut action so that you are getting a little bit more offensive
the
versatility.
Phoenix game where they killed Phoenix. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, he had the 10 assists, correct, in that game. Yep. So like that gives you a different look. I mean, if I haven't seen, I don't fully know, I haven't seen as many games clearly as you have, or the people that are watching this have, to know how much playmaking he has in his arsenal. But if you can do some of that more Princeton stuff out of the high post, I'm always a fan of bigs who can pass because that alleviates and allows you to release pressure in a different way.
I'll pull up some of the film on him because it is interesting out of that game what he was able to accomplish there. And Jalen actually did say the next game that I want to run through some of the bigs here, and Horford's good at that too, right? Like, he can run sets, he can play the high post, he can create out of the low post, not as much as he used to, but that's an option for him. Unfortunately, his offensive game in terms of shot making has just completely collapsed this year, which, I mean, it kind of makes him a very small part of last night's game when you look back on it. His minutes are going to start going down here, and Rob is certainly going to take the upper hand there. But Rob, certainly, the difference I would say between him and Sabonis is that he doesn't dribble well. Like, he is not a guy who can face up. He's not even a guy who can post up like Sabonis can there. So his threat as a scorer from a stationary position is pretty limited. But you look at a play like this, and I'm going to pull up some film from the Phoenix game there. You just hand him a look on the ball here, and get the right view here. You just hand him a look on the ball, and he is going to make something happen. Right here, just a quick catch. Richardson's cutting, and he just finds him.
Right. So, yeah, exactly. Those are some of the types of the actions. I mean, you're seeing a lot of teams run that stuff out of the high post and the elbows where it's a quick split cut between those two guards. And then it's just, you know, it's not even a guarantee of who's going to screen for who or who's going to cut for who. And then you just make a play. Like, that's another option of something that can give them a little bit of versatility. I mean, I even wrote about that exact thing a few weeks ago with Sabonis, because another option out of it that I've seen Orlando uses, which, I mean, I don't think you'd really want to do this with Robert Williams, but they'll have one of the guards then go screen for the big at the elbow, and then you can run an inverse and the big can attack out of that. So a lot of teams are doing stuff out of that. I think that that would give another option in terms of just not having to rely completely on the playmaking of the Jays as much as what it seems like the Celtics are having to do this year.
Yeah, and you talk about that split. It was great for Phoenix because Phoenix was playing pretty small without Ayton, and I believe McGee was out for that game as well. You were able to get him and Grant going at some of their smaller guards out of those. So Grant switches inside here on Booker and gets a pretty clean look over him there.
Yeah, now the question with it would be, because of what you just said, like, that's stretching the floor of a playmaking. The five is going to be out there with Robert Williams. So then you're getting those shots for cutters and potentially better shooters if they do roll out of it and do a dribble handoff. But would teams sag off of him? Like, would they play off of Robert Williams if he kept doing this enough? That's probably what they would do. I doubt they would play quite that close if this was a regular part of the offense. But just to sprinkle it in a bit so that you're getting somewhat of a different look, I think is something that could be valuable for them.
Yeah, so it's twofold, and this is just great cutting by Smart. You don't see that enough out of this team. This was like a breath of fresh air for the Celtics fans out of like 2 years, this game here, especially against the best team in the league in Phoenix right now, record-wise. They were limited, but you were just able to get such great movement like this out of Rob in the high post. And listen, no one's guarding him here, but if you make the right cuts, as you know, Smart and Grant and some of these other guys, and even Brown, who can be so much of a better cutter than he is, you start to feel better about where this offense is going. And Rob, it's on him too to be able to improve and make himself more Sabonis-like in a way.
where he can actually start to attack for himself. You saw it against the Knicks the other night, just catching against mismatches in the post and finishing. That's probably a start for him there, because if he just catches the ball in the post, he can make some of these reads as well. His vision's just so good. But they don't utilize it enough. And even Brown saying, you know, we want to play through these guys, it doesn't end up happening in action. I look at Tatum and Brown and even Smart and Schroeder and just some of the other guys on this roster. It's a lot of good players who I think have looked at this situation over the last year or two here and said, we can solve this ourselves. And they're realizing that just trying to do it yourself isn't going to work. And you got to start to integrate some other guys here and do some stuff. And it's getting better, but it's awkward. It's not natural for these guys. And you can see it in the way that they play.
Right. And it's a question of what's the move forward. I mean, I know that there was reporting this week, I believe out of The Athletic, that it sounds like the Celtics are pretty set on continuing on with Jalen and Jason. And I know
Jason should be, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's what my opinion is. I mean, I'm fairly risk averse when I have, if I were a team and I had two all-star wings on my roster, I would probably first want to see if there was more that I could do to tinker around the surrounding pieces, potentially move Smart, potentially, you know, move some of those other younger guys and see if you could get, you know, more shooting, or at least, like, I'm not saying that you're necessarily going to be able to acquire an elite point guard, but like, just need to name somebody. Like, I think Malcolm Brogdon would help. Like, Malcolm Brogdon's a guy who can play off ball and shoot. Like, his shooting numbers are not great this season, but he can play off ball and shoot, and he can run offense. So just being able to plug in another type of player and that type of archetype between those two, I think would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, the tricky thing is you don't have much to offer in Indiana in that regard outside of Brown if you're going to try to get Brogdon or someone else in the league. I mean, I think it was mentioned, I forget who said it, that Celtics need shooting and playmaking. Other teams do too, and they're not just going to give it up. You know, like, those are the two most important things in the game right now that just aren't easily accessible. I guess the question is how you feel about Rob and Smart, because I don't know how they've extended these two. They've, you know, Smart's been a big part of their defense for years and is a good playmaker, probably their best playmaker, which is fine. You know, he's not the best of the best, but he's good for them. So you wonder what they'll do with him ultimately, and if he does have value around the league. I think he'd be interesting for Indiana just because if you're going for like a soft reset, he's a guy who's pretty ready made to step in there and contribute, as well as Rob, who's interesting because the games played's the big issue with him. Obviously, he's a guy who just keeps pointing up and up and up, and the defense he had last night was just unreal. I think he has like 4 blocks per game over his last 7. So he's one of the best shot blockers, most disruptive pass deflectors, and all this different kind of stuff in the post there. But is it going to take him time to round out to what he's going to be here? Because you do want to start to get this moving for Brown and Tatum here. I mean, Brown's going to be a free agent in 2 years. They're nowhere close to winning, it looks like, right now, you know, battling to the buzzer with Indiana like this. So those are the first two guys you look at ultimately there, but how much does it get you back? And then that's what leads you to Brown. Like, you just, there's not much else here. I guess you could send all your future picks out. The guy I ultimately want is Sabonis. Like, I just think he would look so good next to Brown and Tatum, connecting with them as a passer, giving them an outlet to score in the low post. That's not something they have right now. Is he worse than Rob defensively? Yeah. But, you know, he's okay at that end. He's got the size and the positioning and different things at that end to at least be okay there. And it's an offensive league. I just don't know if picks, Rob, Smart, and some of the young players here, like, let's say Pritchard or something, gets you Sabonis. Like you talked about, it just doesn't make sense for Indiana to move forward with that stuff and Turner, especially when you have Rob and Turner at that point.
Exactly. I mean, if you look at, I mean, I know you had said some stuff about Marcus earlier, but last night I actually thought, you know, before he got hurt, that he did impactful things in terms of, you know, especially when Kiefer was on the floor. Defensively ducking under the screens and being
he's
able to stay attached
defensively.
I mean, he really disrupted that. I mean, Kiefer has a slow release anyways, but that was impacting what his accuracy was. I mean, those were shots that he could have knocked down, but he was being very mindful of who it was that was on ball and what type of coverage he needed to show. And then at the other end, I mean, he was looking to target him. I mean, Kiefer's barely 6 foot tall and he was looking to get in and attack that situation. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that I've liked about Marcus Smart for a while. I just think from the Pacers' perspective, if they were going to be moving on from Sabonis, I think that they would be asking for Jaylen Brown, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was rumored a couple of years ago when both of them were in extension talks, and it didn't seem like the Pacers were going to be able to reach a number. That was reported that, you know, they had at least made contact with the Celtics about Jaylen. That's one of the few players that if that was something that was swapped one for one, I'd be like, you know, that at least makes sense if you were able to run out a lineup with Brogdon and Jaylen, TJ Warren and Miles defensively. You know, I get where you're coming from, and that's an upgrade. The Pacers don't have any wing players to that caliber. It's kind of like when they were going to trade Miles for Gordon Hayward last year. Like, they just don't have anybody who can do all of those things in one body. So, yeah, that would be one of the few players that I would have circled, but I don't think that Boston would be willing to do that and reciprocate and give up Jaylen Brown to take on a big. But I don't see the Pacers doing that for Marcus Smart and Robert Williams. I mean, the Williams fit with Turner doesn't fit, and I don't think that Marcus alone is enough in a way that would make them competitive. That being said, I don't think that people probably realize that Brogdon really struggles to defend the point of attack against smaller guards. He oftentimes, he's okay against wings, but they'll have to move him off. And that in part is why they're doing some of as much hedging as they are. Like last year under Nate Bjorkman, they funneled everything to the rim, which is okay when Miles was out there, but they had a lot of scheme issues because they were rotating through so many different types of defense. But then they were also doing it with Sabonis, which didn't make sense. And here Rick Carlisle has tried to incorporate both, where Sabonis is up above the level and you're doing a lot more with hedging, where, you know, it would be useful, like what they were doing late last night, to have wings out there who can rotate and cover up some of that stuff. So if Sabonis were swapped, there is, you would have to alter. Like, I don't think that you want him 24/7 in a drop scheme. I don't think that's going to be very successful. I mean, he has the same length of wingspan as Jaylen Brown. I mean, that's he's just not going to be the same quality of rim protector. Now, I do think that he's made improvements, like just individually changing the scheme has helped him. And I understand that the Pacers defense overall has not been good this year, but changing the scheme has helped him individually. And I do think that he's moving better as a shuffler and getting out above the level without getting split. His overall technique there is better. And when he gets into the picture, his awareness of where he needs to rotate. I mean, last night he had the one possession where he trapped Jaylen and then rotated over and trapped Jason and got back to the rim and Jason turned it over. Like, that's something you would not have seen last year. And being able to do that degree of ground coverage, he clearly had to have done some agility training over the summer or something to improve. Like, I'm not going to say he's the most mobile four in the league. That's not the truth. There's times where they have to move him off of matchups like Tobias Harris, but if he was playing at solo five, he wouldn't be guarding those types of guys anymore either. So,
and in gameplay, he's not knocking down threes like he was earlier in his career. I mean, I see him pregame last night just knocking him down. And then the game comes and it's not really a big part of his game. I know they've tried to make him more of a floor spacer this year in that Carlisle system, but it just doesn't seem natural for him yet. Maybe it would be at some point, but I'm thinking the next step you would take there in a negotiation between these two teams, I think, is just saying that, all right, the centerpieces of these two rosters aren't quite working here. Let's see if we put at the middle. You know, I guess the Celtics keep Tatum there, obviously, and then Indiana keeps Turner. But at the middle of the rosters there, you swap out Sabonis for Brown and then, say, Smart for Brogdon. You know, sort of a two-for-two like that, I think, is one of the few deals in the league that intrigues me for Brown. Like, I'm just not a guy who is willing to give up Brown in many cases, but when you start throwing out ideas, something like that from a return standpoint does intrigue me a little bit. Maybe even get one more piece from Indiana in that, or a pick or something, just because of the value of Brown going back. That intrigues me just a little bit. Some of the value of adding Sabonis to me gets diminished by the fact that you lose Brown, and I sort of look at him as a connector between Tatum and Brown if you made them a big three there. But you think of swapping out Smart's defense for Brogdon's offense and how that would fit next to Tatum. Keeping Rob is a big deal to me, and playing Sabonis next to him I think would be intriguing. Two passing bigs, and, you know, one of them who could maybe space the floor at some point there. That's the last deal I could think of between these two teams to kind of make something work there. But it just, the idea of giving up Brown, seeing what he did last night, what was it, 26-15-6, no turnovers in 43 minutes. And this is just like the very, very beginning of him cracking open his playmaking game there. And obviously he's just a monstrous scorer some nights. It kills me to give him up. And I'm just not sure Sabonis is enough to make it worth your while. Maybe Sabonis and Brogdon is, and then you finally solve some of your offensive point guard issues there. But it would be tough to swallow for Boston. I really think this season would have to go off the rails the rest of the way to think of doing something like that. But that's an idea that I have.
I think that the Pacers would definitely consider that. If I were Boston, I'd be pretty hesitant. I mean, just because it's not really going to be optimizing. I'm not sure that it would completely optimize what Sabonis can do, because once again, you'd be asking him to be defending at the four, because you're going to want Rob back defending at the rim. So some of these situations where he's having to guard, like I said, an OG Anunoby, a Tobias Harris, where they've had to get creative with some of those matchups and who they're putting him on, are still going to exist. And then also, I just feel like that, and I hate to enter the discourse, but if I was going to give up Jaylen Brown and I wanted a playmaking big, I think I would be more interested in Ben Simmons if I were Boston, just because you can play him defensively on the perimeter. You could still keep Robert Williams around the basket. He's a preternatural playmaker in transition. I think that would make more sense. And hopefully you would also be, I would think that Boston would also be getting some type of pick compensation in that type of a negotiation if they're giving Jaylen up.
You can't go on a podcast, Caitlin. I know lately, this is where it goes, but you can't go on a podcast without talking Ben.
You can't.
Boston's a team that has been talked about there. And personally, I love the idea of Simmons coming to Boston, rejuvenating his career, and kind of sticking it to Philly if they ended up playing them in a playoff series or something like that. But Boston has to send Brown to Philly. And that is just such a, you think of the Red Sox and Yankees trading or something like that. That's just not something they're going to do. So that's another deal I look at. And it's can you send everything else and get Simmons, Smart, Rob, whoever else? That doesn't really work either. So you get stuck again there too. Because Simmons, Brown, and Tatum, that would be a trio, right? The defense there, the playmaking from Simmons, the shooting that Tatum and Brown bring next to him, that would be something. But I don't think you have a path to get there. And again, it's hard to give up Brown, who's a better player than Simmons today, with all that uncertainty going on around Ben, even if hypothetically you think there'd be something you could unlock between Tatum and Simmons. But is that a duo that you think could work if they ended up making that kind of deal?
Ben Simmons, I don't want to sound completely out on Ben, because I do think he does a lot of really valuable things, and I think that the discourse around him has been fairly broken. But at the same time, if I'm being completely honest, to borrow a phrase from Draymond Green, I really do have serious questions about whether he's a 16-game player or just somebody who elevates a team to a middling seed in the Eastern Conference over an 82-game season, and how much that's going to limit you. I think that it makes it tough. I mean, in the case with Boston, it's a little bit different because, people are always talking about Ben Simmons with the Pacers with regards to, he would really fit with Miles Turner. And my question there is Embiid made 11 fewer threes than Miles Turner last year, and Embiid's just an overall better player. And sometimes when we look at floor spacing and gravity, he was posting up, but he's also drawing two, and that opened up cuts for Ben. So that's not going to be there if Miles is playing. When you run pick and roll with Ben Simmons, you got to run it snug close to the basket because everyone ducks under on it. You need to count that he's going to be aggressive on the weak side, and he's going to be cutting from the corner on those banana type cuts, or he's going to be setting weak side screens. And there's times where he does it, and there's times where in the playoffs, like what we saw against Atlanta, it's like he's hiding behind a house plant, and that has to come from
free throw shooting.
Right, and that has to come from him. That's not about his coaches. That's about how much he's going to involve himself and how active he's going to be. So the defense, the way he can push the pace, his vision, that's all real. But at the same time, and then teams will be like, well, if we play him at the four, which is probably, somewhat, obviously, if you still have Robert Williams and Tatum, that's what the Celtics would be looking at. Well, use him as a screener and he can be a short role playmaker. Well, sure, but what if it's an exaggerated coverage in the playoffs and he's still not making or willing to take a pull up to or do anything around the rim?
He never has been either.
And people are not going to come off the corners. That's not a look that you've seen a lot in Philly. Brett Brown did try to play him at the four, I believe, leading into and at the bubble. But if he's not willing to be an aggressive scorer in those situations, you're not going to come off the corners and open up those types of passes for him on the short roll. You're going to stay home and force him to do something. And then, you talk about all the time, oh, surround Ben with shooters. Well, he had shooters in Philadelphia last year. I mean, Seth Curry had one of the best three-point shooting percentages. Danny Green was one of the best shooters in the corners. Embiid shot his highest mark. Tobias Harris was near 50-40-90 last year. It wasn't on high volume, but he did have shooters. And to just compare him and say, oh, it's going to be the same as Giannis, it's not going to be the same as Giannis. If he had the same mentality as Giannis and was willing to attack as much, even if he airballed free throws and did other stuff, that would make him a better version of Ben Simmons. But he does not have Giannis's length. He's not the same finisher as Giannis. And he doesn't really have a well-established post game to this point in time. And that's why it's kind of frustrating, too, when people act like, you know, he and Sabonis are just interchangeable because, oh, they're both hubs and they both can pass. Well, Ben is a much better defender at the four spot or at really any spot than Sabonis is. Like, I will give everybody that. But Sabonis is making $18 million. Ben Simmons is making $33 million. And I do know that Sabonis is going to try to get to the free throw line. And I do know that if he's on the short roll, he's going to go ahead and attack the rim and go through people. And you're not going to have those types of questions about him in late game situations.
Yeah, so much of it is his intent. What's he going to do? Right. What's he going to be willing to do? And for years and years, we saw it. And now Mike be even worse, just him not being out there. I don't know how to read him sitting out for a season. Maybe it is a warranted move based on how Philly talked about him after that series. But at the same time, it leaves a huge mystery there. And you don't just give up on Brown, who's out there doing these things right now, for the hypothetical of Simmons, which is basically all you really have right now. And his status, I don't think, around the league has improved all that much. You don't hear a lot of buzz around him being a guy that teams are interested in. And if he was a great, great player who could really change a franchise, there would be. There's just so many concerns out there about him that I think are reasonable. And, you know, they're from the same draft class. And, like, no one at that draft class would be like, I'm going to take Simmons over Brown right now. And that's something that you have to factor in when you're making that kind of deal. Like, the fit, I think, is what everyone's thinking about. But at the end of the day, in this league, you're assembling talent. And Tatum and Brown, in terms of a talent duo, is just about as good as it gets. It's just the roster's broken around them right now, so I understand why people are going to that place and saying, what can you get for Brown? Can we get a team that's more deep and versatile and accentuates Tatum better? At the same time, I don't know if that interests you closer to a championship. You got to draft better here. You got to do some creative moves. You got to find some low-key talent maybe and swap out some of the young guys who have stagnated, like Romeo Langford and Aaron Nesmith, certainly, and some of these other guys. Like, they're going to have to get really creative to make this work. Might not work, but I think breaking up Brown and Tatum earlier than you have to would be a mistake. Is there anything else you can do here to try to tinker with this roster? Is it just kind of Brown and Tatum patiently becoming playmakers, younger guys growing? Is it just going to be a slower process than fans really want to wait for right now?
Right. I mean, I think you do have to hope that they're going to continue to grow and develop. They're both still young players. But at the same time, there's kind of this unquantifiable thing, too, with both of these teams, where I do wonder a little bit, like, how much of this is just staleness and wondering, like, you know, I think that the Pacers are better than what their record indicates. I mean, their net rating says they're better than what their record indicates. But there's times when you just watch them on the court and there's just this, you know, difficult to describe. Sometimes there's tension that shows up, and that's been better over the last couple weeks, ironically or coincidentally, I guess I should say, with having G League players who are out there having to fight for their position in the NBA and these depleted rotations. And that seems like it's raised the level for the rest of the roster in terms of their competitiveness. But it also just seems like, you know, maybe this group has just been together too long. And I think that's a question outside of Jason and Jalen that they can ask about the rest of the roster, is has this just gone on, you know, a bit too long? And if you bring in, you know, new personalities, new voices into that locker room, does it refresh the core of what you have? And that's not really something that I meddle in a lot as an X's and O's writer, but it is something that I've questioned a lot just watching the Pacers and what type of, I don't even want to say psychological, but what type of boost that might have getting certain players a new start somewhere else, as well as getting players that are currently in the locker room new starts.
Let's talk the X's and O's of it before we send you out of here. When you hear that Ken Brown and Tatum play together thing, from an X's and O's standpoint, what are you thinking of? What are you seeing when those two are out there? And what's going to make that work ultimately at the best version of those two playing together?
Right. I mean, and I won't say this completely cut and dry, because they're not, all four of these players aren't completely identical, but it's kind of like when you look at the Clippers with Paul George and Kawhi Leonard and how some of their offense would get stagnant and it felt very cold, and especially under Doc Rivers, where it was just, you know, like a dribbling isolation machine and there wasn't as much connectivity. Under Ty Lue, they've had more connectivity between the two of them as well as, you know, getting the ball into the middle and spraying out and some of the development they've got from their younger guys. So if you look at Boston, I mean, I think even last night when you watched the overtime back, there were times where the two of them were screening for each other to try to mismatch and distort what the Pacers were able to do with some of the trapping. And
that's all, pretty, you know, new. And
putting Grant Williams in the corner the way that they did, not having Horford out there, not having Schroeder out there, not having Marcus Smart out there, like, guys weren't really playing outside of themselves, I didn't feel, when I watched that back this morning, and they were just allowing the two of them to cook, which obviously not all those shots are always going to fall. And I do think that Jaylen in particular, in some of the games I've watched it late, needs to get better at finding like the second passing window when he gets off the screen and then they collapse and he has two guys. I think there are times where he could be finding Robert Williams under the basket that he just doesn't always see that type of stuff. So you hope that he gets better there. But I mean, I do think that there's room where the two of them, where in some respects you would be switching it because it's wing to wing, but I think that there's ways where you could be involving them in the same actions a little bit more than what Udoka has done to this point in time, or even some degree Brad Stevens, where it's not just one of them doing an isolation at one slot in a pick and roll and the other playing off of it and kind of watching that develop, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And there's this great play. I'm going to try to pull it up before we end this episode here, from the Golden State game, which was a while ago at this point. And you talk about them being in the same spot on the floor, playing off each other there. And then some of the stuff we talked about with Rob earlier and just the vertical gravity that he brings to the table there. There was just this awesome play. I don't even think I'm going to be able to find it through my catalog here. But where they were all, I think there was sort of like a ghost screen from Tatum. Rob set a real screen, Tatum kind of popped out and drew some defense high. Rob rolled down against Draymond Green, who's, you know, one of the best defenders in the league, period. And Green just had no answer for the Brown pick and roll there out of that action. Everyone was really focused on what Tatum was going to do as a screener there, not really setting one, but just being in that area. And then Rob getting downhill. One of my favorite plays of the season, just Rob, Tatum, Brown, those three guys that defenses really have to account for, putting that uncertainty into the defense there and making something happen out of the left wing like they did on that play was one of the best things that they've done all year, frankly. And I do think Rob gets underutilized by both of them. I think that he can make the game so much easier for both of these players, be a connector per se. He has to raise his game too, make himself more of a threat offensively with the ball in his hands rather than just as a lob threat. But those three guys there, there's enough talent between them that I think if all three reach their potential as playmakers, that's your big three, I think. Brown, Tatum, and Rob. And that's probably the escape valve to this core working. But Rob's just inconsistent and hurt a lot of the time, and those two are inconsistent as playmakers. So it's really frustrating. I understand where fans are coming from, wanting this to happen a little bit faster. But there is a world, and I think this is what Udoka's been super patient toward, where those three guys start to get it. And maybe you put some shooters around them, you know, some cutters, just some more active guys. And this offense starts to look a little bit more capable there.
Right. Because, I mean, in the meantime, and you could see this the last 2 years, I mean, including under Bjorkren from McMillan, like if you're not going to have those types of shooters, then you got to do, you know, something to occupy those weak side defenders, whether that's, you know, screening the secondary help, setting a corner pin in, using more exit screens to get guys, remove those taggers, open up ways for Jaylen and Jason to still be able to get downhill and make those reads somewhat simplified with, you know, weak side movement and cutting, which I think is still somewhat missing and bland from, you know, that's something that Udoka can improve in terms of, as well as some of the constant call outs after the media sessions.
I found the play. Yeah, that doesn't make fans happy. They love these players. They don't want to hear them talk badly about. I found this play. I got to show it to you before we get out of here. This is just beautiful. And you don't see it too often from this team. So when it happens, you got to embrace it. This play from Golden State weeks ago. Here it is in its glory. Boom.
Right. So, I mean, it's essentially a double drag with Jason as the top screener and then just leaking out so that you're having to put tension on that tagger between Robert Williams and Tatum. I mean, there's more variations of that they probably could be using where both of them are involved in the action at the same time. And then even if you look at their two weak side guys that they're in Richardson, I think it's Richardson and Smart.
Yep.
I mean, they could be setting a dummy pin down for each other, even just to distract those two defenders and make that an even easier play. So yeah, I mean, I think that more stuff like that's the way to move forward with the roster.
Yep. And Smart's not a great four spacer. Richardson's an okay one, but they're both active in that regard and can do stuff like that. Paint's still a little bit crowded here, but Rob just gets up so high on these kind of plays that, you know, Draymond doesn't even have a dream of getting up there with him. And most centers don't. So Rob's a special player. There's some people that really think he could be an all-star and one of the best centers in the league. I think the people that watch the Celtics every day are like, yeah, it's not quite there. Then he's going to miss a game with a sore toe and all that momentum's going to be killed. But at his best, and he's starting to piece it together more and more often there, you just see how special of a player he is in the pick and roll there and how much of a steal he was. The 27th overall pick in that draft. Probably Danny's last great pick. And gives him a chance now going forward. So, Caitlin Cooper, it was fun to do this for an hour with you. Break down the game, and you're one of the best at it. Make sure you follow her at C2_Cooper and read her at Indie Cornrows, covering the Pacers, one of the best out there doing it. And we'll see where they go on Wednesday. These two teams meet again on Wednesday night in Indiana at 7 o'clock. Hopefully Duarte's out there. I've been excited to see him in a full game for the first time. He's an exciting player. Pritchard's got to get back, too. Those two college teammates out of Oregon have been really good. And, you know, stay tuned for her coverage, her tweets during the game. We'll both be putting some clips out there, I'd imagine, from this one. And hopefully it'll be more of a smooth game start to finish, Caitlin.
I was hoping for more, like, Tatum rifling passes off of Rob's head and Lance Stevenson getting 8-second violations after missed free throws. Like, I was hoping for more of that.
All right. Thank you, Caitlin. Yep. Let's show some sponsors here real quick, too. Can't forget them. The reason we're here. Make sure you go to, if you're watching this and enjoying it, Calm. This is a no-brainer as things get hectic out there. Calm.com, meditation, sound, sleep, all kinds of different things to help you with your mental health. And your premium subscriptions, 40% off, is a Dome Theory and CLNS Media listener. Calm.com/garden. And this is another timely one. LinkedIn. Everybody's looking for candidates for their jobs right now. It's a crazy job market. So go to linkedin.com/garden and they are going to give you a free job post. I'm trying to find the banner for that one, but you know the deal. linkedin.com/garden, free job post. That's what they're giving you. Caitlin, appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
Yep. Talk to you guys later. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.